and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for September 17th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, 30 years of China's one-child policy. What jump-started the microbial response to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill? And the ecological significance of tool use by New Caledonian crows. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about programming robots to lie, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
China's one-child policy may have slowed population growth over the past 30 years, but it's also led to a severely aging population. So,
freelance news writer Mara Vistendahl reports in this week's Science on China's ongoing one-child policy and the detrimental effects demographers say it's already starting to have on the country's society and economy.
In a few decades, you're going to have just a glut of senior citizens, and the country's getting old before it gets rich. So you see the same thing that's happening in Western countries and in Japan, but the difference is that China does not have the same safety net for the elderly. And then at the same time, the policy has also led to an increase in the sex ratio at birth. So couples who are intent on making their only child a son end up aborting female fetuses. Chinese parents prefer sons for many reasons, but one is to carry on the family line. And also as a form of old age security, a daughter marries out of the family and a son is expected to care for the parents in old age. And so the projection is that by 2030, you'll have 30 million more men than women of marriageable age in China. And so that's a big social problem as well.
Originally, how long was China's one-child policy meant to be in place?
Well, in the open letter that announced the one-child policy 30 years ago in 1980, the government actually listed a target of one generation. And at one point in the letter, they said, in 30 years, we can reconsider. So this year is a very important year for that reason, because now the 30 years have passed, people are starting to ask, what next?
And is there any consensus that this one-child policy has stabilized China's population?
Well, that's a matter of debate. The Chinese government now claims that the policy has averted 400 million births over the past 30 years. And there's a group of scholars who've been doing fact-finding on the policy have found that the actual number is probably closer to 100 million. And at the same time, China's fertility rate did drop greatly over the past three decades, but the same trend has happened throughout the developing world. So you see similar drops in Thailand and Albania and Brazil. So there is a lot of debate over whether the one-child policy was actually responsible for the drop in fertility rate in China.
And at present, what is China's fertility rate?
Well, even that is a matter of debate, because the government now says that it's 1.77 children per woman. So that's the average number of children that are born to each woman over her lifetime. And this group of scholars says that it's actually probably closer to 1.5, which is pretty low. That puts China between Switzerland and Canada and really where the developed world is.
Non-replacement, in other words, it means long-term decline for the population.
China is definitely below replacement level. There's no debate over that.
So now that these 30 years have passed, the 30 years originally set out in implementing this policy, are Chinese officials taking steps to dismantle the policy, or are they keeping up with enforcement?
Well, the official government stance is still that the policy will remain in place. There have been no official statements suggesting that it will be relaxed. But what is interesting is that there is this group of scholars and scientists and some former government officials who have been pushing for the policy's abolition from within China and from within the system. And they have been allowed to operate, more or less. So there are signs that the government will give in to change at some point. One of the reasons that it's been so slow in coming is that the bureaucracy of the Family Planning Commission, so that's the organization that enforces the one-child policy, is bloated, and it's now around 500,000 people who are working for the commission. And so that's a big lobby, and they're resistant to change.
Because all those people then would essentially lose their jobs, right?
Yeah, they would lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. And you just have this huge infrastructure that's been implemented over the past 30 years. And logistically, it will be difficult to change that.
Is enforcement still necessary? Are Chinese women interested in having more than one child at this point?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. And the group of scholars that has been pushing for the policy's abolition, they've done this study in Jiangsu province, which is a pretty economically developed province north of Shanghai. And it's also one of the first provinces to transition away from the one-child policy. So there they have an exception that allows couples to have more than one child if just one member of the couple is an only child himself or herself. So that means at this point, now after 30 years, with the first one-child generation grown up, many of those couples are eligible to have two. And so the scholars have gone in and asked them, are you actually going to have two now that you can? And the results are interesting because many women say that they won't. And many women have also said that they would. And then in a follow-up study done a few years later, they actually hadn't followed through on their intentions. And the big reason that women give for not having an additional child is that they don't want to spend on education and activities for more than one child. So it's not that they're poor, but that they've kind of hit this level of middle class existence where you really focus on providing your child with a good education with all the opportunities that you can.
Whether this one-child policy continues or not in China, what are scientists, demographers saying that this policy means for China's future, given the 30 years that have already passed?
So in addition to the one-child policy leading to a severely aging population and a skewed sex ratio at birth with more men than women, it's also going to affect the labor market over the next decade. So from 2010 to 2020, the number of 20 to 24-year-olds is projected to drop by 45%. So it's a huge drop in the number of young workers. And you're already seeing labor shortages in some factories. And demographers say that this will affect the economy as well.
If China's one-child policy is completely abolished.
Yeah, well, if China's one-child policy is abolished, these problems will still be in place. And the country will still have to deal with the effects of the skewed sex ratio and the aging population. So it's not a question of whether the population is going to age rapidly or whether there will be many more men than women. Those are definitely happening. You see that already in China. So the question now is how quickly they can get rid of this policy that's hurting the country demographically.
Mara Vistendahl, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Freelance news writer Mara Vistendahl reports on China's ongoing one-child policy and the detrimental effects demographers say it's already starting to have on the country's society and economy. Read the article in this week's Science. Online at scienceexpress.org, find a policy forum on family planning as a way to alleviate global poverty and achieve several of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals. The Deepwater Horizon blowout in the Gulf of Mexico is the largest offshore oil spill in history. But because it was also the deepest offshore oil well in history, the spill was different than past underwater oil spills, and so there have been a lot of questions about how much oil was spilled and where it all went. But of course, it's not just oil that flowed from the broken wellhead, but natural gas, too.
We knew very early on in the spill that natural gas was a major concern.
David Valentine of the University of California, Santa Barbara, studies how microbes interact with one another and with the environment.
Particularly when the initial devices were put on to try and capture the flow, they immediately clogged with gas hydrate. And I found out through a number of people contracting with BP that the gas content was somewhere on the order of 30%. And it was basically being ignored. It's not in any of the oil budgets, yet it's 30% of the total that was flowing out.
And Valentine says most of that natural gas, including butane, propane, and ethane, is predicted to be trapped in the plumes of hydrocarbons previously reported to be about a kilometer below the ocean surface. Valentine's team sampled water near the Deepwater Horizon blowout in mid-June and estimated that there was about twice as much gas trapped in the deep subsurface as there was oil.
Very quickly, within 12, 24 hours of starting our sampling, we knew that the gases in the area around the well in June, about 10 kilometers away, were somewhere between 100,000 and a little bit higher even times the natural background level. And in some cases, the methane, for example, would be more abundant than something like dissolved oxygen, which is at fairly high concentration in the deep ocean.
But as Valentine and colleagues report this week in a paper published online by Science, even with those high concentrations of hydrocarbons compared to oxygen, microbes are degrading it, or at least degrading the ethane, propane, and butane.
The natural gas is spawning a microbial population. And what we now need to figure out is what that population is then doing with the oil. We think we're growing up a very rapid bloom of microorganisms on the natural gas, particularly the ethane and the propane and the butane. And then the question becomes, once you have this population, will they turn to those oil components and biodegrade that rapidly, or will they not?
The answer is uncertain. In part, that's because the Gulf of Mexico is so big and the number of samples scientists have taken is so small. For example, with the data taken in the weeks before Valentine's team's data, Terry Hazen and colleagues reported concentrations of oil-degrading microbes twice as high inside the oil plume as outside it. But with the data taken in the weeks after Valentine's team's data, Rich Camilli and colleagues reported very little evidence of microbial degradation in and around the plume they tracked.
In comparison to the Hazen paper,
again, David Valentine of the University of California, Santa Barbara,
we see some of the same organisms that they saw. They saw that there was one organism dominating the community in their samples, and we see two different organisms dominating the microbial community in samples that we look at. We also see their same organism in other samples, and I think that just indicates that there is a certain amount of either variability in time or variability in space with the microbial population.
And Valentine suggests, by the time Camilli and colleagues took their data in the weeks following, there was little evidence of microbial degradation because the microbes had finished off most of the dissolved natural gases.
When we compare the results that we got with Camilli's results, I think that they match up rather well. And I think that the difference between the two is that in the samples they looked at, the higher hydrocarbons, the gases, the propane and the butane and the ethane, may have already been removed from those, meaning that once those are gone, the respiration rates are likely to drop off quite dramatically.
Rich Camilli agrees. Camilli is a researcher with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and is not affiliated with Valentine's team's paper.
So this paper presents sort of another facet of this puzzle, and the microbes were acting predominantly on propane, which is a very big finding because there has been some question as to exactly what the microbes were degrading in the plume to cause oxygen drawdown.
But, says study author David Valentine,
the levels of oxygen have not dropped to the point that microbes would be inhibited, that oil-degrading microbes should be inhibited.
Meaning that it is still possible for the oil-degrading microbes to devour the oil in these deep water plumes, not just the natural gas.
And so if you put these three papers together,
again, Rich Camilli of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution,
it suggests that these deep water plumes contain large amounts of natural gas, which is unlike most every other oil spill that's occurred, large-scale oil spill, in that not only is it oil that's being spilled, but it's also natural gas. And the natural gas is what actually the microbes are utilizing first. So sort of like children with the decision whether they want to eat vegetables or candy, they'll tend to go with the candy, and these natural gas components are a lot like candy to the microbes. And then eventually microbes may degrade some of the other compounds,
but at a rate that, so far, looks to be much slower. You can find Valentine and colleagues' paper, Propane Respiration Jumpstarts Microbial Response to a Deep Oil Spill, online at scienceexpress.org. You can also find a collection of Science's research, news, and policy articles relating to the Gulf oil spill, including Valentine's team's paper, online at sciencemag.org/hottopics/oilspill. Humans use tools, of course, as do several other primates, and it's been observed in elephants, sea otters, dolphins, birds, and octopuses. But that's about it, meaning there aren't enough species for scientists to compare them with one another in order to figure out the evolutionary origins of tool use. So scientists have turned to investigating the ecological context in which animals use tools. And in a paper in this week's Science, Christian Rutz and colleagues report that New Caledonian crows, in the wild, get a substantial amount of their protein and fat intake from prey they get by using stick tools. These crows are famous for their ability to select the appropriate tool to get at food in the lab, but are incredibly difficult to study in their natural habitat. Science's Stuart Wills spoke with Rutz from the University of Oxford about how the team did it. Here's Christian Rutz.
It was known that these crows use tools naturally in the wild for some time now, but what we didn't know is how important their tool use really is nutritionally, how much of their daily diet consists of tool-derived food, and how much of the food they take in they obtain without the use of the tools. And this is a question that is very important when it comes to addressing the question of how tool use evolved in these birds in the first instance. And in our new study, we use stable isotope profiling techniques where we use chemical fingerprints to get first estimates of how much these birds actually rely on tool-assisted foraging.
So specific elements of their diet have different isotope ratios, and you could back that out from studying samples from the birds?
That is correct. The basic premise of stable isotope profiling is that you are what you eat. So a consumer accumulates specific isotopic profile in his own tissues by consuming food items. And so by sampling both tissues from our study crows and from the foods we know they eat or we suspected they might eat, we could infer in what proportions they consume these different dietary components. And very importantly, we knew before we started the study that the crows use tools for fishing for large wood-boring beetle larvae. And these larvae, because they only eat wood, have a distinctly different isotopic signal from all the other foods the crows were known to eat in our study area. And so we could trace the signal of these beetle larvae in the crow's tissues. And we, in our case, sampled crow feathers and crow blood. So we could detect how much of these larvae an individual bird must have had consumed when the tissue was synthesized. And this could in turn be interpreted as a proxy measure of how much they relied on tool-assisted foraging.
And so where did this take you? What did you find?
We found that these grubs are very nutritious, they have very high fat content, and they contribute disproportionately to the diet of these birds and are nutritionally very important. And that just shows that it pays off to be a good tool user. And this is the link we were looking for. So we think we have identified a strong selection pressure on these birds. If you are a good tool user, you have access to a nutritionally very rewarding but otherwise hidden food source.
Well, I suppose a question that comes to my mind, you know, in light of that is why don't we see this kind of ability in other animals, given the kind of possible selective advantage that you've documented here?
And that's still a puzzle we haven't solved, which is, in fact, very difficult to solve. Ideally, what we would like to do is employ the comparative method of evolutionary biology, and we would like to have a look at the tree of life and map on this tree all the tool-using animal species that are known to science, and then search for ecological correlates, life history correlates, and then we would get firm answers as to why it evolved in particular lineages but not in others. But unfortunately, this is something we can't do, quite simply because there's so few tool-using species in the world. So the only approach that is potentially possible is to look at those few species that express this rare behavior and look at its nutritional and adaptive significance under contemporary conditions. And that was exactly the angle of our study, why other crows that may have access to comparable hidden food sources don't show this behavior, we can only speculate about. One possible explanation is that in other habitats with wood-boring invertebrates, there tend to be woodpeckers that exploit this niche. And so in New Caledonia, we know that there are no woodpeckers, and the crows fill this niche, and they seem to have come up with a different solution to the same problem of extracting nutritious prey from their wooden defense.
So where do you think your group will be taking this work next?
We still have a very keen interest in understanding better how important tool use is for these birds. And we think that with our stable isotope methodology, we have established a new way of getting quantitative data comparatively efficiently. If we had attempted to get similar data by observing our crows, we would have needed to spend decades of sitting in hides and observing crows. And I still think we wouldn't have got the same data that would have enabled robust estimates. So we think this really sets the scene for looking at larger scale variation. We may wish to sample crows across the island of New Caledonia and see how much their dependence on these wood-boring beetle larvae, at least, varies across the island. We could look at seasonal effects. And ultimately, what we would like to do is establish a fitness link. We would like to show that good tool users really enjoy enhanced reproductive fitness by preferentially feeding their offspring with tool-derived food. Maybe crows that are raised by good tool users are heavier. Maybe they survive better into adulthood. Maybe they reproduce better later in life. So these are the big questions for us.
Christian Rutz, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
Christian Rutz of the University of Oxford, speaking there with Science's Stuart Wills on the ecological significance of tool use in New Caledonian crows. Finally today, David Graham, online news editor of Science Magazine, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about programming robots to lie. Why would researchers program robots to lie, Dave?
Well, Rob, it's a great question, and one they don't really answer so well in the study, although they do say, you know, humans lie a lot. We often lie for good reasons. For example, you might not want to tell somebody they're having a bad hair day. There are analogous situations for robots, especially in military uses, where it would be useful for a robot to behave deceptively or at least differently than an enemy might suspect.
So how in this study were the robots deceptive?
Well, Rob, there is a very simple setup in the study, and sort of think of it as a game of hide and seek. A robot sits there, and you can actually see a picture of this robot on the site, and you can actually see a video of what's happening here on the site as well. But these robots are these sort of little gray things, and they've got cameras mounted on them, and they've got four wheels. They look like almost like little dune buggies. And you've got a robot sitting there in front of three different colored markers. One's green, one's red, and one's blue. And the markers are all on paths to different hiding places. And these hiding places are essentially little cubby holes that the robots can hide behind. And what happens in a normal game of hide and seek when these robots aren't programmed to behave deceptively, if the robot goes along the blue path, then it's going to knock over that blue marker on its way to the hiding place. And this is what they call the hiding robot. And then if the researchers put a seeking robot or a finding robot in afterwards, and they say, okay, finding robot, you've got to figure out where the other robot hid, the finding robot is programmed to go, okay, I'm going to look for which markers knocked down, in this case, a blue marker. I know the other robot went along the blue path. I'll go to the blue hiding place, and voila, I found the robot.
And what happens when the robots are programmed to deceive?
So when the hider robot is programmed to deceive, what it does is it'll knock down a marker, but it won't necessarily follow the path that that marker is on. So for example, as you can see in the video, the robot, say, knocks down the red marker, but instead of continuing along that path, it backs up, all of a sudden goes down the blue path, for example, and hides in the blue hiding place. And what that does is when the seeker robot comes along, it goes, oh, well, that robot knocked down the blue marker, must be hiding in the blue hiding place, goes, checks there, and surprise, the hider robot's not there because the hider robot has deceived this finder robot.
So is there a way to program the seeker then to be aware that the hiding robot might be deceptive?
Well, that's an important question, Rob. And one of the reasons the deceit works so well in the study is because that second robot is programmed to trust what it sees. And the authors say, you know, if the seeker robot was just a bit smarter, programmed to be a bit smarter, the deception wouldn't work nearly as well. So you've got bit of a gamed situation here because one of the robots is very trusting, the other robot's very deceitful. But if the robots are programmed to be a little less trusting, probably more a little bit like humans were, then the game of hide and seek might turn out a lot differently.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, speaking of things hiding, this next story is about tiny chemical modifications to DNA that have been hidden for many years, but researchers are finally starting to find them and figure out what they do.
What are these chemical modifications called?
They are called methyl groups, and basically what they do is they bind to DNA, and they act as sort of a volume control knob, and they can turn the activity of a gene up or down. They can even turn it on or off.
The science of epigenetics, then.
Exactly. This is called epigenetics. And what's really interesting about it is, you know, we've thought for a long time that when it comes to thinking about our genetics, it has 100% to do with our genes. If we have a specific gene mutation, it might lead to diabetes, or other genes control height or eye color or whatever. But what's interesting about these epigenetic changes is that it's another level of regulation in the body. So it's saying that it's not just your genes that are important, it's how these genes are modified. And researchers have been studying these for a few years, and they're not exactly sure how they work and what particular conditions these epigenetic changes might be associated with.
So what did researchers study the epigenetics of in this study?
Well, researchers were looking at the epigenetics of obesity, and specifically they looked at 74 Icelanders who had been in a study for about 4 decades studying various things. And so there was a lot of data on these people. And the researchers looked at their DNA and they looked for these epigenetic changes. They analyzed over 4.5 million places along the genome of each of these people. And what they found was they found a handful of regions where a lot of people tended to have these same epigenetic modifications.
And these were changes that happened during their lifetime.
Well, that does happen. In fact, some epigenetic changes you inherit from your parents, just like you inherit your genes from your parents. And some epigenetic changes develop over your lifetime. But in this study, what the researchers found, they found 13 of these, what they're calling methylation sites, so these sites where there are epigenetic similarities between a lot of the people they looked at. And they found that at these 13 sites, there was a strong link between the methylation pattern and whether or not a person was obese. Some people with more methylation in a particular region were more predisposed to obesity, whereas others with less methylation in another region were predisposed. The pattern varied from site to site. But what the researchers saw overall was, beyond just the genes, they were finding this connection between these epigenetic patterns and obesity.
So all of these people might have the same gene, but it was a function of whether or not they were turned on or off, or how high the volume was turned up, as it were.
That's exactly right.
Any way to modify the volume then, or turn it off or on?
Well, it's a little too soon to say that, Rob. What the researchers do say is, well, first of all, they say that just because you have these modifications doesn't mean you're necessarily going to become obese. It's just like with genes. You can have mutations that predispose you for certain things, but that doesn't mean those things are actually going to happen. A lot of it has to do with other factors such as environment. What the researchers do say is that we're trying to enter this era of personalized genetics or genomics, where a doctor could look at your gene profile and figure out exactly what conditions you're going to develop and hopefully try to treat you proactively. And we've got DNA, we've got genes already in there, but now we can throw in these epigenetic changes, and it just gives doctors and researchers another tool, another way to monitor people to figure out the best way to personalize their health.
A better way to say whether someone's at risk for becoming obese or not.
Exactly.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from protecting people from obesity to protecting mountains from erosion. This last story is about how glaciers can sometimes act like geological blankets for mountains.
What's an example?
So the example researchers looked at in this study was in the Patagonian Andes, and this is a mountain range that's on the west coast of South America. And some of these mountains have been heavily eroded by glaciers. And you may remember that glaciers are supposed to be this really destructive force in nature. They're almost like nature's buzzsaws. They can grind down mountains. They can even carve valleys. So they're a very destructive force. And that's what researchers saw in some of this mountain range. They saw these mountains that should have been a lot bigger, but were pretty smooth and ground down as glaciers passed over them about 5 to 7 million years ago. But there were other mountains in this range, in the more sort of southern part of the range, that were a lot higher and were a lot rougher. And it looked like they hadn't been touched by glaciers at all, even though researchers knew there had been glaciers in this area millions of years ago.
So what do they suppose happened?
Well, to find out what happened, they went to visit this mountain range and they collected a lot of rock samples, and they did something called thermochronology. And basically, what this involves is shooting a laser beam at grains of these rock samples that they collected. And this liberates certain isotopes in the rock. But the basic idea is this technique can tell researchers how young a rock is. And here's why that's important. If you were to pluck a rock off the surface and this technique told you that the rock was very young, chances are that meant it actually came from the interior of a much older mountain, but the older parts had been eroded by a glacier. Whereas if you were to pluck a rock off a mountain and this technique told you that rock was very old, then you could assume that that mountain hadn't been very well eroded because all of its old parts are still on the surface. And what the researchers found was that these mountains that seemed very well preserved, the rocks on the outsides were also very old.
Suggesting then that the glacier actually didn't come to the top of this mountain or just didn't erode it?
Well, basically that it didn't erode it because they know the glaciers were here. And what they suspect happened is, based on some climate data that they have, is that the more northerly mountains that did get highly eroded, the temperature was warmer there. And this causes a thin layer of water to form under glaciers because you've got these warmer temperatures. And that helps the glaciers slide down the mountain. And as you can imagine, you've got this ginormous chunk of ice sliding down a mountain. It's going to cause a lot of damage, cause a lot of erosion. But in these more southern latitudes, the temperature was actually colder. And that meant the glacier was practically frozen in place. It couldn't slide down the mountain. And in fact, what happened is because you had these glaciers covering these mountains, they almost acted as a sort of geological blanket or styrofoam so that when other elements that typically erode mountains like wind and water came along, these mountains were protected by these glacial blankets. And therefore, they didn't erode nearly as much as the mountains farther north.
Any broader implications then?
Well, one of the researchers says this shows that there's a really strong link between climate and mountain building or mountain erosion, because here it was just a small difference in temperature caused these massive differences in what these mountains look like. Something that geologists have long debated.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into on the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about how tracking your friends might help predict flu outbreaks and also new insights into the history of the moon. And on Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about research into animal-human hybrids and just what the public thinks about that. And also, we're continuing our coverage on stem cells, what's going on in the U.S. since a federal judge effectively banned federal money for stem cell research. That ban was recently stayed, but there's a lot else going on. There's also a lot going on with the midterm elections in the U.S., which might influence future stem cell policy in the U.S. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the September 17th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai and Stuart Wills for their help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.